Steve here from Production Music Tools. We are very excited to release Symbol Effects Bode in collaboration with our friends at 52cues.com. This sample collection features 68 unique Bode symbol performances, offering a broad spectrum of timbres, textures, and tones, and is the perfect choice for tension and trailer music. These were performed on a 22-inch Stag traditional China Lion cymbal, and every sample has been expertly recorded and performed by composer Dave Croft of 52 Cues. Incorporating these top-notch samples into your project is a breeze. Simply drag and drop to create stunning transitions and infuse your mixes with added depth and texture. You can find this pack at productionmusictools.com as part of our sample pack product line.
Five tracks to one library, five tracks to another agent. Don't give them the same tracks. Give them, if you're going to split it up, just give them a few tracks. Give them five here and five there, and you know, split up your songs, but don't let them do the same tracks. So that's what I'm doing with my library now, and when I renew my clients, I'm asking for that exclusivity, and telling them they can pitch their other stuff anywhere. And also, it's also a team effort.
What is happening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the 52 Cues Podcast, your weekly insight into all things production and library music. Whether you are just curious about the sync industry, or maybe you are ready to pitch to publishers, I promise you, you're in the right place. My name is Dave Croft, and it is so good to be with you today. And if you're watching this on YouTube, then why don't you give it a thumbs up? Or if you're listening to the audio on the go, then how about a five-star review? Either way, be sure to subscribe, because I talk about production and library music every single week. Today's episode wouldn't be possible without the incredible support of our family, friends, and neighbor subscribers of 52 Cues, who not only keep the community alive and thriving, but as member subscribers, they also get access to extra features like workshops, live streams, cue breakdowns, weekly feedback sessions, and hundreds of hours of video archives, and the opportunity to submit to real music publishers. So maybe you're ready to get started and push into a career in production music, then why don't you head over to 52cues.com and join us. It's free to sign up, and memberships start around $4 a month. So we are wrapping up week 13 of 2024, and how has your week been going? My week has been really busy. Next week, here at 52 Cues and also at Full Sail, it is our spring break. Now, typically, I could take off during spring break, Christmas break, and fall break. I will, or I guess summer break. I will take the week off, which means no live streams next week, no cue breakdowns. We will be having a podcast episode because I am going to be producing it ahead of time. And isn't that the way? It's like, in order to not have to work during a vacation, you have to work twice as hard before you leave. Or if you don't, then it's going to be a pile of work waiting for you. And I think the lesson there is that if you do the work ahead of time, then you can really unplug and you can spend the time during your vacation or during whatever time you set aside. It could just be a weekend, right? Or it could just be going out to the movies one night. Like, if you budget your time appropriately, then you can really spend that time free of any sense of obligation. And so, as a chronic procrastinator, this has been one of the things that I've worked on a lot in my life, and especially in my professional life. Not putting something off that I don't necessarily like have to do right now because future Dave can do it. But what ends up happening almost without fail is future Dave gets robbed of the peace that comes from taking care of your business ahead of time. You know, we talked about in one of the past episodes about, you know, eat your frogs, you know, that Mark Twain quote that says, if it's your job to eat a frog, then eat it first thing in the morning. And if your job is to eat two frogs, eat the biggest one first, or something like that. And that kind of applies, that if you do the work ahead of time, if you budget your time, budget your money, whatever, then when it comes time to spend that time or money, then you can do it freely. And so that's been my week so far. Planning ahead of time, producing extra podcast episodes, trying to get ahead of the writing. And we are preparing the house. We have a bunch of 52 Keys family folks coming to Orlando. We're calling it the family reunion. That is next week. Really looking forward to that. And so we are preparing the house for that. But I am working hard ahead of time so that I have time to spend and not have to work. And I think that's the life lesson. It's not all that fun when you're in the middle of it, but here we are. As far as the cue that I wrote, which would be last week for my week 12 on Expedition 52, is a new type of cue. It is a cue which I am calling a European dramedy cue. Which means, if you remember a while back, I did cues which were cinematic world cues. And I'm working on multiple albums, specifically for Discovery Channel, that are world flavors. And so the cinematic world was kind of world music fused with tension music. Well, this album is dramedy cues fused with Italian, French, and Greek traditional instrumentation. This cue that we're about to listen to is called Escargot to be Kidding, which admittedly is much more of a visual pun than a pun sound. Escargot, it looks like the word got, and so it looks like Escargot to be Kidding, but I can't bring myself to say Escargot to be Kidding. But it creates a visual pun, and this features plucky dramedy pizzicato strings, some clarinet from Vienna Symphonic, and me on melodica trying to do my best impression of an accordion. So that was Escargot to be Kidding. I had a lot of fun writing that, and I'm really looking forward to writing the rest of this album. And I've got so many tortured title puns in store. I can't wait to share them with you. And for folks who are family and friend subscribers, they can see a complete cue breakdown of this cue over at 52 Cues. And for our neighbor subscribers, this was a cue that I wrote during the live stream. And so you can watch this cue be created from scratch. I am so happy to be joined on the podcast today by Chuck Milan of Milan Marketing. And Chuck, among the many hats that he wears, and one of the reasons I really wanted to bring him on the podcast today, is he is a sync agent. And I've got lots of questions as far as what's a sync agent. But before we get into all of that, Chuck, welcome to the podcast. It is so good to have you with us today.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here, too.
And
admire your success. And I've been going on your website. And my God, you've had a very, very successful career. I started off as a drummer vocalist myself, and went to music school too. And you went way beyond everything that I tried or attempted to do. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much, sir. I really do appreciate that. Yeah, I don't know, man. Drummers, first of all, we're everywhere. And so many drummers and percussionists make their way into composing and music production. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. I don't know if it's just the use of rhythm, or we're used to playing kind of a supportive role. And that just makes us predisposed to making, you know, film music or TV music, perhaps. I'm not sure. But like I said, it's really good to have you with us. And before we start, and we were chatting a little bit, you know, before we started rolling, Chuck is not a lawyer. And these are Chuck's opinions. And Chuck's, I'll let you say a little bit more about that. Just wanted to make sure that we're offering up kind of suggestions and opinions. But, you know, you're not a lawyer.
Yeah, I just anything I say is just being facetious about the lawyer thing. I mean, sometimes when I got out of college, someone said, sometimes I sound like a lawyer. I'm really good with language, thanks to my mom, who used to read to me when I was a boy growing up. And I'm really good with language, and I am a little bit perfectionistic. I did work in finance for 10 years for companies like Warner Brothers and Panasonic, so I'm like, anyway, a little bit, perfectionistic that way. But anyway, anything I say is just my own opinion and my own take on it. Dave, you're certainly probably a better expert on production libraries, since you have worked in that, you know, in that field with those people. But this is so. Mm-hmm. What I'll do is share my take on it, and you're welcome to jump in and share your experience as well as far as music libraries go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important anytime, whether you're watching a podcast like this or, you know, enrolling in a class or, you know, going to a seminar or a workshop or something like that, I think it's just important to keep what you're hearing in context, because anytime you're looking to, you know, make a living or make money off of creative endeavors, there's an element of risk involved, you know, and so all we can do is communicate our own journey and where we've been, and we can try to read the tea leaves as far as where the industry might be going. But your mileage may vary. So we just wanted to say that on the front end for sure, you know, just so we manage expectations. And if anybody is promising you success, my advice would be to run away from them, to turn away, because nobody can promise success in this kind of industry, just because there are so many variables. All we can do is, like I said, point you in the right direction and equip you with the tools you need. So, Chuck, we met during one of the Production Music Association's Zoom sessions, and we were in a breakout room. Absolutely wanted to have you on, and you just recently, as of this recording, came back from the 2023 PMC. How did that go? How was that this year?
Oh, it was fabulous, and I was amazed at the growth and the number of attendees. They broke records. It was a record attendance, 900 attendees.
Oh my gosh.
I was amazed. I said to myself, oh my God, I've seen so many bald-headed older men in there like us.
It's the 21st century comb over, man.
Yeah, it was, all composers and so many from all over the world. There was guys for Germany, England, not only composers, but I mean, attendees came from England, Germany. I saw some in Australia. I think there was some others from, you know, Mexico, of course. And I say, of course, because it's so close, but there was others from other, there was some from Asia that were there. But anyway, it was fabulous. And they had some really great panels, and I was blown away by some of the, there was a lot of data. I said the other day that it seemed like in the whole conference, the 12 hours, you know, 36 hours or so that I spent there, I probably heard like 30 minutes of music. Unfortunately, that was the award show. So it was not, you know, it was not about, it was all about production and statistics and numbers. And one of our a library owner said, who was also a drummer, he started off as a drummer and successful guy. That was Randy Wachler. Randy Wachler, you might know Randy. But he said that it's becoming more of a computer science than yeah. was, you know, years ago. It was less technical, but now it's even more and more technical all the time.
Do you think that's because the just the tools have become increasingly more sophisticated, and we're doing so much kind of in the DAW and in the box?
Yeah, it's not only people. I'm not a music producer. You are, but I work on computers, and they're talking about the libraries are so sophisticated now. They have these. They're huge. There's like APM is the probably biggest and maybe most well known library. They were formed by Universal. They're associated. They're a joint venture of Universal Music and Sony Music. They've been around quite a while, and I'm not promoting them. It's just they're the ones, you know, I'm most familiar with. They have over a million tracks, over a million tracks. And I asked myself, how do they do it? You know, how do they know what to pitch and what not to pitch? But I guess they have sophisticated search engines. I think they use, I'm not promoting them either. I think they use Source Audio or Audio Network, perhaps, to help them search and organize their files. Then, you think that's mind-blowing, BBC, British Broadcasting Company, sent a couple of representatives from England, and they said, and this is mind-boggling too, it's like thinking about the universe and the number of stars that are available. They said they have 36 million tracks. Now, I don't recall how they say they use them, but that's, they have 36 million tracks.
Now, I mean, it's a wonder anything ever gets found. Like I'm in Discovery's catalog, which has, you know, 700,000 tracks, and I am impressed when, you know, something of mine gets placed, knowing how many tracks there are. But 36 million, I my heart breaks for the music supervisor who has to open that up and start kind of crate diving for music. That's metadata, man. That's what's got to be so important.
They must have an incredible search engine. Yeah. So anyway, or engines. So with that said, so anyway, it was a great conference, and they had a nice award show. And one of the trends is the music libraries used to be instrumental only, or primarily instrumental. And now they are also taking on like band type tracks with vocals, which is used to be the has been primarily where sync agencies fall in. Sync agencies, music publishers cover. Now, traditional music publishers. They also, or record companies, pitch and masters. So what is the basic difference was between a sync agent and a music publisher and a music library, according to my best take on it, my opinion, is that libraries have been primarily instrumental music. They work with a lot of cues. They are very much immersed in the trailer and advertising world and promo world for television and films. Trailers, promos, that's mostly television. But there's also now we have all these other media, forms of media. You've got TikTok, you've got YouTube, and those are other worlds in themselves. But then you have the publishers, which our publisher is also a legal type entity. Being a publisher is a a business in itself, which is part of a lot of writers and have their own publishing. So they writers are commonly their own publisher as well, or they're at least they're a half a publisher. That's sort of a piece of the ownership of the copyright. Publishers that can be huge. I mean, you got, who's a publisher? Dave, you're probably a publisher.
Yeah, it's really interesting kind of getting into that side of things. Yeah, for sure.
And then Sony Music and Universal Music are publishers. And we know there's sort of a world of difference. You're both successful, but I talk about as scale wise.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
They're bringing in millions or billions of dollars and have hundreds of employees and artist composers like yourself and have a music publisher entity.
Right. So I understand. So a sync agent, somebody who is like yourself, you're not necessarily working with composers necessarily. Are you more work with music with lyrics? Do you find that that's what quote unquote syncs more or is that kind of your main thing?
Yeah. Sync agents, including myself as a sync agent, what we work with, and publishers and music libraries typically also get a back end royalty. They may typically take a percentage of your publishing, right, Dave? Mm-hmm. That's pretty common. And
all the publishing, and then we get all the writers. Yeah.
Some are all the, yeah, you still get your writer's share. So they get the publishing and publishing share of the copyright. And then, sync fees, I guess sometimes you get a sync fee and sometimes you don't, right?
Yep. And often that is also split with the publisher as well.
Split with the publisher. But I mean, you yourself sometimes get sync fees, but not always, right?
Not always. Yeah. A lot of times, like I do a bunch of stuff for sports broadcasting, and so much of that, there's no upfront, you know, it's all on spec, and you get, you know, if you hit, you know, a primetime play, you know, on network TV, then that can be somewhat lucrative, but very little upfront money for that stuff.
Very little upfront. Yeah. I'll go into the sync agencies. Sync agents like myself, we usually work with vocal music and usually a band's pre-recorded music, like albums of bands or singers that have that hire a band, or producers that, you know, have a band project, but they're already completed. What we call in this industry commercial music,
okay,
versus production music. It's made to be sold to the public, CDs or whatever music.
It's, sure, Spotify, streaming. Yeah, it's not music.
Yeah,
it's music that's released as an artist being an artist doing their art.
Right, and trying to promote their art to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Public and sell albums, Taylor Swift and, you know, not Travis Kelce, but Taylor, you know, artists like that. And sync agents, many of them do not take a part of the publishing, do not take a piece of the publishing. Mm. We only split the upfront sync fee.
Gotcha.
Now, there are some that do. And so it's, and the percentage sync fee, they can, the percentage of the sync fee, which is the upfront money that you get for a placement, can be anywhere from that they charge is from anywhere from like, I think 25% up to 50% of the upfront money. And then, many of them, or most of them, many of them do not take a part of the copyright or the publishing. They're not taking any of the publishing. So they don't get any royalties. Now, some do, and the way they do that, but they don't take a the copyright on your song, what they'll do is they will retitle them. They'll go on the when they have the music placed, when the music is placed, they will retitle your track on BMI, SCAP, or CSAC. They will retitle that track wherever you're publishing it. They will retitle that track and like put a little code in front of it, in front of the name of the song, so that, and then they will get publishing on that use of the song only.
Right. But
the song is used in a TV show. If they may ask for the publishing on that particular song in that particular usage. So all the other usages in the world for that track belong to you, but that particular usage on that show would be attributed to, you know, the music library, and they code it somehow.
And unlike, you know, if I write a cue and I give it to a publisher, they're going to assume the copyright, and I can't go put it out on Spotify or anything because the publisher owns the copyright. And so if they want to put it on Spotify, that's all well and good. But somebody who has a sync agent that has written a song that they've released on Spotify, the fact that it gets placed into a film or TV or a game or whatever, that doesn't preclude them from still being able to play that song live or release it on Spotify. They don't have to pull that down or anything. Is that right?
No, the sync agent only has a, is only entitled or eligible, it is a better, maybe a better word, eligible to pitch the music to for film and television. And usually, as in some of the agreements, they can be exclusive or non-exclusive. Mm. And with the sync agents. So but either way, they have, let's say, I'll talk about non-exclusive. I have some clients that are non-exclusive. I have some that are exclusive. Non-exclusive means they can have other people pitch their music as well. And me. So anyway, the, but there's some issues with it. I have an older client that I, a couple older clients that I, when I renew, I'm going to renew them as exclusive, because I've heard horror stories about companies being pitched by multiple, the same track by multiple sync agents because they were non-exclusive, and then people getting hurt, and also the supervisors getting angry and upset and confused because they're getting pitched the same song by multiple people and so forth. So anyway, the but a lot of especially the newer artists, they like non-exclusive, and they like to, they think it's cool to have, anyway, now I'm like into, you know, opinion and emotion about it. But they, some think it's wise to have multiple, multiple companies represent the same track. However, I was just, I was over at also at the, GMS conference, Guild of Music Supervisors conference. And there was, a guy from, who's with, Saatchi & Saatchi, doing commercials, and he also was a pitch guy. He also was, I think he might have been an artist. He was previously a pitch guy. He pitched his own library. Now he's on the other side as a music supervisor with Saatchi & Saatchi. And he recommended, he said that you give five tracks to one library, five tracks to another agent. Don't give them the same tracks. He said, give them, if you're going to split it up, just give them a few tracks. Give them five here and five there, and split up your songs, but don't let them do the same tracks. So that's what I'm doing with my library now, and with my the next, when I renew my clients, I'm asking for that exclusivity, and telling them they can pitch their other stuff anywhere. And also, it's it's also a team effort. Now, if if somebody is out, is out playing their music, and somebody hears it and says, "Oh, gee, I really like your music. I'm going to put it in a film or TV show." And then, and I'm working as well. This helps me to get, I will get I'm entitled to represent that the track for that song, and so it's a little helpful to me. I find that I'm working harder for those that I have exclusive with, because I know someone else is not going to be competing against me down the road. So
if somebody's listening right now, you know, because this whole channel is super focused on production music, but we also have, you know, songwriters and folks who, you know, singer-songwriters and release music. What makes an artist a good candidate for sync music? Is there a certain skill you have to have from lyric perspective? Is there a certain type of song or structure that just you have found in your experience syncs better? What's the really the best candidate if we have folks who are listening?
Well, there's a combination of most of my clients. I come from an artist. I was previously an artist manager, so I kind of have I represent the artist. Try to work with the artist. I believe in the artist. And some of the musicians that I've had, some of the clients I have been people I've known. I've seen them perform live here in the LA area. So that's how I connected with them that way. And then, others I found in a search. You know, a music supervisor said they were looking for like Irish music, for instance. And so I did a search, and it wasn't much of a search, because I thought of one guy I know who did Irish music, and then I said, oh, I know another guy who does Scottish music, but that's pretty close. So I will, I contacted them and brought them on just for that project.
Gotcha. Are sync agents, are they looking for established artists, you know, with a following and a YouTube presence and maybe Spotify releases and Instagram, or is that not as important in the sync space as it is necessarily if you're trying to kind of build a career as a performing artist?
I mean, that's all, we all want to, you know, we would all love to have the Beatles, who else, Motley Crue or any of those icons. We'd love to have those established artists, or even the more, you know, current people. You know, they're likely already with a big music publisher and also a record company, and the record company is pitching their master side and they all work together. So the publishers are pitching the song so they can get song royalty, they can get publishing money and, writer's royalties and sync for the song, so they can get, so they're all pitching for the big artists. Right. And, and of course, I would like to have someone, even someone I had, I was approached by from being on the PMA. There was some different one artist, and then there was one that was like a producer, and she was pitching me music from her multiple artists. And there was one group that was pitching me, and they said they had some success, you know, they had some successful tracks, and it was really good. It was upbeat, kind of current pop music, kind of like the real trendy type. It was pop and well produced, and I wanted exclusive on it, because I don't want to be competing with two or three or more other entities, you know, for the same tracks.
Sure.
If they're more, you know, they can be more selective, of course, if they have a success. We want people with a successful track record, but then again, they may be more picky because they've had a successful track record.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's easier to find somebody who has a little bit, you know, more exposure, whether it's through the socials or YouTube or Spotify or whatever. But it's not necessarily a prerequisite. It's just it doesn't hurt. It helps things along.
And we also have to be, it also helps if they're organized and willing to do the, as you probably are well aware of, there's so much the metadata that's required now. It's becoming more and more a metric business. Like I said, with the, you know, the only way with these millions of tracks that are available now, the only way they can be tracked down is through, you know, the metadata embeds all the contact information and legal information in the tracks. So the metadata is really important. So it has to be people that are willing to, you know, provide. I sort of provide a service for the music supervisors beyond what, when, you know, that they have all the metadata is, I make sure all the metadata is in on their tracks. And the artists I've had too, they're newer. The newer artists, if they're new to Sync, if they're new to Sync, then it's more work because we have to educate them on the Sync business, including putting all the metadata and making sure they're. My last client she does children's pop music, and it's well produced. There's a production duo in New York who produced the music for her, and they're 3-time Grammy nominees. For children's pop, and so anyway, it's well produced and all that. But you know, I had to, you know, her producer agreement. She had an agreement with the producers, but it wasn't signed.
That seems like a pretty important part of a contract.
Yeah, it wasn't signed. I looked at it, and she sent it to me. They didn't sign it, so I said things like that. It took like to onboard the client. Which is, you know, to bring all that metadata. I mean, it took months. There was over the holidays too. To get all the data, and I sent her an Excel spreadsheet to fill out, and she did a really good job on it. It took a while. You know, artists have that information already, like in their iTunes.
Yeah.
And in the tracks, that makes a whole world of difference.
You know, it kind of communicates to the Sync agent that you're ready for business, right? You at least understand the business, and if a contract gets put in front of you, you're not gonna, you know, kind of freak out and like, oh, what do you mean you want 50% of the Sync? It's like, well, I mean, that's the business. I remember my first library contract I signed. I didn't know anything. I didn't know any better. And when the library asked for publishing shares, I was like, no, this is my music. But if you come to the table with things like your metadata sorted out, things like understanding the business, then you're telling them that you're ready for business. And so I totally get that. Another question I had for you, for our listeners or viewers who might be interested in this, what do you think makes a song Sync friendly?
They like songs that kind of get the let's say easiest to understand, short intros. You know, I have one of my clients, she has she has really long intros. I don't know how many measures. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 measures before she gets into the vocal. And you know, they don't want to, you know, they give a listen to your track like, you know, 10-15 seconds. And you know, they want to hear the vocal, they want to hear the, you know, chorus and all that really quickly.
Don't bore us, get to the chorus.
Doris, right? Don't bore us. That's one first thing I learned when I worked for National Academy of Songwriters was, don't bore us, Doris, get to the chorus.
That's right.
That's really important that it's, you know, kind of tight. That's what they said, you know, the track should be tight, avoid the long intros, keep it moving. They like upbeat also is good for Sync and also, you know, for everything really. They like upbeat. There is some drama, but you know, they have a lot of often they'll have score composers do the score for you know, the dramatic scenes, but sometimes they might want a slow song, a singer songwriter ballad or something like that, you know, on some of the TV shows or films.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Lyrically, are there any lyric taboos, or are there any tips you could give from a lyric perspective to make a song sing friendly?
Yeah. There is, especially like in the hip hop world, you know, they don't like, what do you call it?
Like language and profanity, or?
Yeah, profanity. Yeah. Profanity is often a no-no, and, maybe excessive violence might be a no-no. If, you know, you don't want to talk about violence, like, I want to kill that guy, or you don't want to mention, right. You know, sometimes we think those things, but they're really, you know, out of anger, but you don't put it in a, you can't put it, you know.
Yeah, any real kind of explicit content, whether overly violent, overly sexual, or overly
violent, overly sexual. Yeah.
Yep.
And they also say, it's good to, like if you're creating, songs for sync, keep them a little more broad. Keep it broad, like if you know, like don't re- you know, like referring to a certain city or something. I mean, if or a circumstance or even religious too. I heard a religious track last week, and you know, if they would just keep it broad. You know, I know help will come my way, instead of saying, I know God will help me, you know, just say, right. I know help will arrive, you know, that sort of thing. You know, you don't want to put anything in there that might turn some people off.
Or even just limit its usage, you know, because as soon as you mention God, then it can't be used. You know, you could take like a praise and worship song, right? Yeah. You take a praise and worship song.
If you get praise and worship, you send it. I've worked in that community. You can, you know, send it to a praise and worship production.
Yeah.
But otherwise, if you want a more generic, you know, if you want to have it on regular television, you might want to take out the God and the Jesus and all that, and or whatever, any kind of, you know, religious names. You might want to take that out. Just make it more. Little, I hate to say the word, but generic or universal.
Well, no, it makes it more. I'll use a different word. It makes it more flexible. You know, it makes it more flexible for an editor. And this is something that production music composers do all the time. There's the reason we write in largely 4 and 8 bar chunks, and then 4/4 or 3/4 safe keys, safe tempos. You know, we're not. There's a reason we do that, is because we need to make life easy for the editor. And so if you have a really great song with good lyrics that's flexible, that can be used to support somebody else's narrative, you know, in their storytelling, whether it's for a commercial or for film or whatever, then that's a win-win. And if you are a praise and worship songwriter, then like you said, make an alternate version, you know, with maybe some lyrical tweaks, maybe say you with a capital Y instead of God. And now suddenly you can interpret it kind of both ways. But, and I think it's just being really practical about it, you know, and if that kind of trips your internal kind of, oh no, that feels blasphemous or heretical or whatever, then maybe don't, sorry, I don't, not to put too fine a point on it. Don't try to pursue sync placements for your song.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they, one thing, they look for lyrics, and we embed them in, I embed them in all the tracks for my clients, if they're not already there. You know, often the clients will, they're embedded in the metadata, the lyrics, and often they will, especially the studios and networks, they insist on having the lyrics to see what the song is about, and because they don't want any of that negative stuff that's going to say somebody that they were triggered and killed somebody because they heard something in a song. And there's been some lawsuits like that. Somebody committed suicide because they heard somebody else talking about that in the song. And so you don't, so that's what they insist on, having lyrics for the songs They may look at the lyrics before they even listen to it.
Yeah.
And with metadata too. I heard there's music supervisors now, before they even listen to your track, they can go right on whatever, you know, I use the Disco platform,
mm-hmm.
But there's also even on iTunes you can go on Song Info and check to see if the metadata is in there. They'll look for a copyright, you know, is there someone I can talk to about this? And they'll can look at lyrics and see if the lyrics. There's too much heat.
Yeah, as soon as you start, you know, pushing your art into the intersection of commerce, then these are all considerations that have to come to the table. They have to. And so I imagine, you know, Ice Cube has some of his music released in video games or like television commercials, and they're going to give them different versions, you know, of his music. Migos and Cardi B, their music is in a Foot Locker commercial, right? They are not going to put the full lyrical content, and that's not a judgment call about that artist or that music by itself. But as soon as you start saying, you know what, I want to use my thing to help sell shoes, my music to help sell shoes, then it's no longer about you. And so all these things kind of come into play.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if folks want to get in touch with you, and I'm not sure, you know, I don't know if you are listening or watching this and you think that, that maybe this is some space that you want to reach into, how could folks get in touch with you, Chuck?
Well, they can just visit the website, as you mentioned, or reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Gotcha. And we'll have those links in the description. But if you are driving or listening to this out jogging or something like that, then it's milanmarketing.net. And we'll have links to that. But it's a really fascinating space. I am eternally grateful to have you on the podcast, because I'm not a songwriter. I'm not a singer. And I'm always really, really impressed, like eternally impressed, by folks who can just conjure lyrics out of thin air. Maybe people feel the same way about me, like playing drums or whatever. But I have so much respect for songwriters, and I'm glad that we have folks like you who are helping them navigate this kind of commercial application of their music, and helping to hopefully, you know, make a living making music. But Chuck, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
You're welcome, Dave. My pleasure. Great being with you. Great to be here.
Once again, a huge word of thanks to Chuck for joining me today on the podcast. And as usual, we will have his links in the description below. Also, want to give a huge word of thanks to the family, friends, and neighbor subscribers of 52Qs who pay their actual real-life money to keep all of this going. You notice you didn't hear any embedded ads for mattresses, meal plans, or plugins, and that's because we are supported by listeners and viewers just like you. So if you want to join us, help support the community while also getting extra perks like we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, live streams, workshops, Zoom feedback sessions, cue breakdowns, hundreds of hours of video archives, and the ability to pitch to real music publishers, then head over to 52qs.com. It is free to join the community, and memberships start at around $4 a month. But that is going to do it for us this week. You definitely want to tune in next week, where I am joined by composer and producer and publisher and all around cool dude, Timothy Andrew Edwards, who's going to tell us about balancing creativity and originality with just doing the reps. How do you balance multiple income streams? And what about forming your own production music library? So you definitely want to tune in next week. But I hope that you've had a great week 13, and I'm looking forward to hearing amazing things about your week 14. And how do I know it's going to be amazing? Because I trust and believe that the universe has amazing plans just for you. Until next time, peace. The 52Qs podcast is copyright 2024 818 Studios, all rights reserved. The music played on the podcast is copyright of their respective owners and is used with permission and for educational purposes only. For more information, including joining the community or becoming a member subscriber of 52Qs, head over to 52Qs.com.
Did you know that more and more libraries organize their catalogs as albums, complete collections of cues that all share a similar theme or purpose? But what does that mean to us, the composer? Do we have to write an album in order to get placed in a library? And if so, how do we get started and how can we even be sure we have that many ideas? Well, if this sounds like you, then the 52 Cues Album Accelerator is your answer. This self-paced program with over 6.5 hours of video content, discussion threads, articles, and resources will guide you through the entire process of creating a production music album, ready for library usage. We give you tips on coming up with an album concept, finding inspiration for composing, cue form and structure, and navigating project management and deliverables, all while working towards finding and pitching to libraries who need what you're best at writing. Plus, you'll receive a 90-minute one-on-one Zoom session to listen through the cues in your album, go over your pitches, and discuss strategies for library placement. So head over to 52cues.com/accelerator for more information and to sign up today. Again, that's 52cues.com/accelerator.